This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to take a look back at the L.A. punk scene with three people who helped define it. John Doe and Exene Cervenka, co-founders of the band X, and Dave Alvin, who co-founded the Blasters with his brother Phil. After leaving the Blasters in 1985, Dave joined X for a few years as their lead guitarist, replacing Billy Zoom. John Doe has a new book called Under the Big Black Sun, A Personal History of L.A. Punk. It collects his personal essays, along with essays by Dave and Exene, Henry Rollins, who fronted Black Flag, Jane Wiedlin of the Go-Go's, Christine McKenna, who wrote about the punk scene for the L.A. Times, Robert Lopez, a.k.a. Elvez, who played guitar with the Zeros, and Tom DeSavia, a music publisher and former journalist, and A&R man who produced the X anthology Beyond and Back, and edited the new book with John. John Doe, Exene Cervenka, and Dave Alvin are going to perform a couple of X songs for us. X still tours together, and next year marks the band's 40th anniversary. That's a long time, but when you listen back to their records, you still feel the energy and excitement. Let's listen to the title track of X's debut album, Los Angeles, released in 1980. As the description says, in Rolling Stone's list of the 100 best albums of the 80s, no album has succeeded better as a snapshot of a city and its punk subculture. John Doe, Exene Cervenka, Dave Alvin, welcome all of you to Fresh Air. So I want to ask you all what you thought was like new about punk and what drew on the past in punk. But first, John, I thought I'd ask you to read a poem about punk that you have in The Big Black Sun.
Yes. I didn't really write this as a poem, but it kind of looks like one of those list poems. Punk rock songs are not all screaming and yelling, three chords. Most Ramones songs are not. 2 minutes long, stupid lyrics with no leads, fast, loud, and atonal. Punk rock songs are provocative, immediate, hook-driven, the title usually repeated many times, specific, fast, slow, and in between.
I like that. So what do you think was like new about punk, and what do you think drew on from the past?
Just the attitude was new. Freedom. And what it drew from the past was the danger and a little bit scary and a door that you maybe shouldn't have opened.
And you write, you know, that X's melodies were simple, but the chord changes were often one step off of what was expected. I think, like, the melody is often a little off, too, in that respect. Like, I'm thinking, for instance, of Johnny Hit and Run Pauline. The notes just go to this weird, I don't know if it's like a minor place, but it's just kind of becomes flat in unusual places.
I don't know. You know, it's nothing that we planned. It's just the way it came out.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
One of the things that was going on in music at the time is that everything was all brainy and white guys and just thinking, and it was so much intellectualization and so many notes and so many long, you know, songs and all that kind of stuff. And that was all left side of the brain, and then the right side was punk rock, and it's just saying, screw all of this, I'm going to just do something and see what happens.
So I'd like you each to describe something that you think was unique to punk, and more specifically to LA punk. Exene?
Well, it was youth-based to some extent, although it was a free-for-all for outcasts. Anybody belonged to punk that wanted to be there. Didn't matter how old you were, what you were like, persuasions. So it was similar in that way. I think the thing that probably set it apart was It had an eye more to the future than the immediate present, even though we were so present-based, like everything was happening now. We also wanted to save the world to some extent from what we saw coming, especially what I saw coming, which was the corporate takeover of culture and things like that. We wanted things to be, real, and we thought that this music was going to prevent that from happening because people would realize, oh, wow, this is what real music sounds like. We don't need corporate music and we don't need corporate culture.
Oh, mission accomplished. No more corporate music.
Yeah, right? Hey, you know
well
what?
Well done, guys. Yeah.
Hey, you know what?
What?
We were the ones trying to stop all that and no one listened to us. So it's not our fault that people are where they are at now.
Dave, anything you want to add to that?
Well, I was attracted to the L.A. thing because of the sense of community. And, and inside of that community was, various factions and cliques and this, that, and the other. But with the Blasters, we kind of floated around the cliques. But even inside, even with the cliques and sometimes the warring factions, everybody looked out for each other. Everyone lended a helping hand. X helped the Blasters helped Los Lobos, the Germs helped X. You could go down the list. And what always amazed me was the huge variety of sounds that came out of the LA scene, where certain scenes were maybe more limited in how they approached the music in LA. In that period of time, you did have everything from X to the Dickies to the Screamers. There wasn't any rules, really,
So I would like you to all play a song, like an X song for us, and see how it sounds now acoustically in the studios of NPR West.
Well, we can do that. And Dave and Xine and I, after being asked to do a number of benefits and having other band members that will remain nameless, not wanting to be, benefiting El Salvador and that war, Dave and Xine and I thought, let's just do a three-piece and we'll just do some fun stuff. And so we made the Knitters, which was part of the, early Americana thing. So this is a kind of Knitter version of an X song, which is called In This House That I Call Home. And let's try to stay on time and see if it happens.
Punk rock, baby.
Yes,
punk
that's
rock.
Right. 1, 2, 3, 4.
A 100 lives are shoved inside. Guess right. Indian host and a visiting wife come out of the bedroom, straightened and clothes. In this house that I call home. In this house that I call home. Beautiful walls are closing in. Looking at you, you're having a nightmare. Over tombstone shoes, I reach to surround you, but it's too soon. In this house that I call home. In this house that I call home. Nobody knows the party rules, gotta get in, but there's no room. In this house that I call home. In this house that I call home.
Thank you. That was John Doe, Xine Cervenka, and Dave Alvin performing the X song In This House That I Call Home. And there's a new collection of personal essays about the L.A. punk scene that's called Under the Big Black Sun, A Personal History of L.A. Punk. And John, Xine, and Dave all wrote essays for that. John edited the book. So since we just heard your great harmonies, John and Xine, can you talk about how you came to the unique sound that you have together?
Well, John is a really great singer, and I'm not.
That's not true.
And so when I was, 20, I never sang, and he liked one of my songs and wanted to sing it with Billy, and I said, if I have anything of value on this planet, it's just one song. No, you can't have it. I'm singing it. So I kind of got in there. Anything went then in the punk days. So it was just a good time to experiment and try to come up with whatever we wanted to do. And that's what we came up with. And it was not studied or learned. It was just kind of a crazy combination of things.
And you'd never sung before?
Nope.
So kind of the DIY aesthetic of punk gave you permission to sing even though you didn't think of yourself as a singer?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if that aesthetic had been established yet. I think we kind of all started that ourselves. So it wasn't like, oh, everyone's doing this, I can do it too. It was just kind of like, I don't know, it was just in the air.
In those days in the 70s, in the larger pop culture, everything was being planned, you know, and it was the beginning of nothing you would hear hadn't been approved by a committee, you know, and that went from advertising all the way down to popular music. It seemed that the sort of thing that made me turn up the radio when I was, you know, 8 years old, you know, the car radio with my mom driving, that thing had disappeared from music. And so when I heard, for example, X, the first time I saw them live, and heard the harmonies. Yeah, I heard all sorts of things going on that, you know, I heard Richard and Mimi Farina happening, whether they knew it or not. You know, I heard the unique kind of folk Appalachian blend. I heard all these things going on that, you know, you didn't hear on the Love Boat. You know, and in those days, things like the Love Boat, the kids today don't realize, you know, just how oppressive pop culture had become.
So can you go around the table and each share a story from the late 70s or the 80s from the punk rock scene in LA that kind of typifies for you what the atmosphere was like that was so kind of exciting and or dangerous, something that wouldn't have happened at any other time or in any other place?
Oh God, no pressure. In 79, we became friends with this band called The Brat, and they were from East LA, and we had them play with us a couple times. And Teresa, who also contributed to the book, invited us to a party in a backyard where they were going to play. And Xena and I went there, and we were really excited because this gave us, you know, having all these young Latino kids coming in was like, this is for real. It's not just a bunch of white runaways that like our music. So we went there, and it was great, and the Brat were playing, and they had a kind of pop sound, but they were a little more strange, and it was great. And then some guy pulls out a 45 and just starts banging off rounds, like up in the air, 45 pistol, and just shooting off rounds, and everyone just like scatters a little bit and goes, oh, damn it, you know, Uncle Tito is like gone off again, and he gets hustled out, and someone gives him a good talking to, and next scene, and I thought, wow, this is cool, this is punk rock, and you know, it didn't actually seem that dangerous to me. That's the weird thing.
Dave, you got one?
There was a club called the Starwood that I loved. And the Starwood was like, it had a dance club and it had a live music club. It had a balcony, big balcony, that if you had played the club, you could get into the club and hang out in the balcony. And every musician in town, no matter who was playing, was in the balcony trying to get drunk, trying to do this, that, or the other. And to me, a lot of the LA scene took place in that balcony of the Starwood. But then to get into the Starwood, especially with the rise of hardcore punk, you had to walk a gauntlet because there was a special entrance for musicians and this, that, and the other. But to get into that thing, there was a gauntlet of skinhead kids that you had to pass through. And every night was like this initiation rite where, you know, where like they do in New Guinea where there's guys in a line and they're hitting you with sticks, you know, just to get, you know, and you just want to go to the club and have a beer, right? But I loved that club, and I loved the, sort of like in Kansas City back in the 30s with the Pendergrass and the Corruption created the great music scene of, you know, that gave us Count Basie and Lester Young and Charlie Parker. The Starwood was owned by a guy named Eddie Nash, who was this gangster, a gangster, drug dealer, murderer. And I'd have to go settle up with them sometimes. You know, we'd play, the Blasters would play, and then in those days I was the sort of manager, gig guy. And so I would go at the end of the night and sit at Eddie Nash's table in this little office and pick up the money from this gangster. And so it was no different than Louis Armstrong playing for Al Capone or these kind of stories. But the Starwood to me was ground zero of L.A. It was all ages. Kids could get in. They could drive from Pomona or Pacoima. They could see X. They could see Fear. They could see the Germs. They could see the Blasters. They could see the Go-Go's. They could walk the gauntlet. They could get in fights. They could dance. They could fly through the air. And so it's that wonderful little bit of art and corruption meeting, you know, and to me, that's my memory. That's my, you know, that was my focal point of that scene.
You know, I think for me, one of the greatest things was I lived down the street from the Star with John. We lived right there. We could walk there, you know, but the Whiskey A Go-Go, of course, to me was just talking about clubs and scenes. I thought about that as being Johnny Rivers and the Doors, and I just thought of it as, you know, it's a mythical place. And the thing about going to the Whiskey for me that was great was if we were allowed in and we hadn't been, like, kicked out or whatever, was walking down Sunset Boulevard to get to the Whiskey and having to walk a gauntlet again of Hell's Angels. They'd have their motorcycles parked on the street, and then they'd be leaning up against the wall, so you'd have to walk between them and their bikes. And as a 20, 21-year-old, you know, it was really exciting and scary. But Mario, who kind of ran the Whiskey, he'd always let us in. John would talk to him. He'd go, all right, go ahead in. He wouldn't charge us. We'd see Susie and the Banshees or Blondie and all these great bands and all the local bands. And one day they said that I had a tab, and I could just get anything I wanted. Anytime I wanted to go to the Whiskey, which was probably like four nights a week, I could go and hang out, and I could just sign my name and get anything I wanted. And pretty soon it turned into this thing where I would be sitting in a corner booth drinking martinis with all these, like, the more, like, down and out type people and stuff, just sitting there all eating cheeseburgers. And I would just sign for it every night. And everyone, I was just like buying everybody cheeseburgers, drinking all these martinis. And I felt like the queen of the world at the Whiskey in the same booths. You know, it could have been the Doors or Johnny Rivers. It was just so exciting. And I felt so grown up and so sophisticated. And then, of course, one day I got the word that there was no more tab for me.
So let's talk about the mosh pits in LA Punk. And I'm curious what it was like for you to be on stage looking down on the mosh pit, and if any of you ever did the thing where you jump into the pit and people hopefully support you.
I'm going to definitely field this one.
Okay.
I'm definitely going to field this one. Yeah. The first person I ever saw jump into the audience was me, okay?
Oh, no.
And that happened at the Mask when there were like 14 people and the stage was 4 inches tall. In other words, that started in the punk days of people commingling with each other. The band and the audience were one. We wanted to blur the lines. No one was a celebrity. I'm on stage, you're on stage. I'm in the audience, you're in the audience. We were interacting with each other physically, jumping up and down, grabbing each other, just being kids. The mosh pit is the organized version of that that came much later in the hardcore scene where men run around in circles. And I think that describes both of those scenes kind of a little bit. The hardcore scene was different. So that was a much later creation. We didn't hurt each other or have an organized version of that. We were just more like spontaneous than that. So no, when we first started seeing that, we were like, what the heck?
When you started seeing the more violent version of the mosh pit, is that what you mean?
Well, when we started, like Dave was talking about with the gauntlet, it's like, whatever happened to just, you know, walking down the street and going into the club and having a good time? And so all of a sudden it became very, in a weird way, it was kind of like almost a political correctness thing. Like you had to behave a certain way to be allowed to be a punk rocker. And then we were like, we didn't know where they were coming from with that. So
yeah, it became this thing of... In the early days, there kind of was no rules, right? And then, I won't say what year, but it was early 80s, there became rules of this is punk rock, this isn't punk rock. And when you would walk the gauntlet or when you would play a gig, you know, and some 16-year-old kid decided that, no, you weren't punk rock and you're going to get a beer thrown at you, that kind of thing. It, you know, it kind of soured me eventually on the scene because the violence got to a point where it seemed like there were guys that were, you know, they heard about this stuff called punk rock and you could go and you could bash into each other in front of the stage. And then it became, I'm going to go beat somebody's brains out tonight because that's what's cool. And that became kind of weird.
Well, Dave, you tell a story in Under the Big Black Sun about a bottle that was thrown at you. Would you tell that story?
Well, I had a few, you know. everybody did in those days.
Sorry to hear it, but go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, no, there was one particular one. I had a 61 Fender Mustang, and I still have it, but that was the guitar that I played back then. And we were playing the Cuckoo's Nest, opening for an Orange County hardcore band called The Crowd. You know, a lot of the people in the audience liked the Blasters, and it was okay, and everything's cool, everything's great. But then there's an element of the audience that hated the Blasters. You know, we were almost like their older brothers who liked rhythm and blues, you know, and they were going to show their displeasure. And, yeah, one kid threw this beer bottle really well, and he threw it right at my head. And I raised, in one of the maybe the greatest moment of my life physically, I raised the guitar up to cover my face at exactly the time that it got to my face, but the guitar got in the way. And yeah, there's about a 6-inch long, 1/4 inch deep gash in the Mustang to this day from that beer bottle. And, you know, that kind of stuff happened. You know, I remember it was in the 90s, about in the mid 90s, when I started relaxing before I went on stage, because I could go, oh, wow, nobody's going to throw anything. I think those days are in the past for me, you know.
And
yeah, it was very important to keep your eyes open.
Yes, at all times.
Very important.
Did you ever wonder, like, what is it about the music that is connecting with that kind of chaos and violence? I mean, you had obviously your own kind of energy and anarchy and defiance and anger, but it wasn't about beating people up, and it wasn't asking people to commit harmful acts against each other, and certainly not to throw bottles at you. So like,
what happened was punk converged at the same time that Southern California suburbia was collapsing, and people were getting divorced, and their kids were doing drugs in the morning before school because mm-hmm. it was on the coffee table, and drinking. And there were all these homeless kids and all these lost kids that were getting into skateboarding and surfing and looking for a connection. And, you know, the gang thing was definitely starting up. And I think that it was just a misunderstanding with the media kind of portraying punk as violent through the Sex Pistols kind of stuff and the spitting, because the spitting didn't start in L.A. till 1980, and it ruined everything we owned, and I never got it out of my clothes. And I think it was just this weird convergence of a timeline thing with these poor kids were really, they were very angry, and I think they just misunderstood.
I agree with that, but I'd add that it's something that you can't really explain. It's like, why do people want to have sex after listening to Elvis Presley?
Well, that's pretty obvious.
I was going to say.
Yeah.
Well,
why do
but
people want to have sex after listening to Lawrence Welk?
You can't.
That's unexplainable.
No, it's a feeling is what it means.
I got it. We're kidding you.
No, the music was fast, and the music was, like, chaotic, and it was, like,
yeah.
And so it's this primal scream, and people mm-hmm. just go berserk. And
yeah.
It took me a while to realize that when the shoe got thrown on stage, that probably the person who owned the shoe didn't throw it.
Yeah.
It was probably his friend who ripped the shoe off of his friend and threw it on stage. It's like, there, have fun getting home, dummy.
For all the discussion of the violence, which was a part of that scene, I don't think that it was the scene.
Mm-hmm. And, I agree with that.
And so, you know, we could tell stories for hours about weird things that happened. I once saw John literally smash a guy's hand to bits on the stage of the Starwood, you know, because of this guy was making lewd gestures at Exene, and John's foot took care of the guy. You know, we all have stories, hours of stories like
who,
that.
Me?
You, yeah. I was up in the balcony drinking a beer, trying to meet a girl, and then saw your... Anyway, but the violence that was part of the scene wasn't the scene. It wasn't what got you up every morning, because in those days there was a buzz in the air. And every night there was a different club with a great band playing. And the creativity was electric.
Can I ask you to do another X song acoustically in our studio?
Sure. Shall we try the World's a Mess, It's in My Kiss?
That's sure. A great idea.
One, two, three, four.
All things are untied. telling lies. There are no angels, there are devils in many ways. Take it like a man. The world's a mess, it's in my kiss. 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 We can't take it back and pull it out of the fire and pull it out in the bottom of the night and pull it out in courts of red disease. There's a drag in my system. There's a drag in my head and body. There's some facts here that refuse to escape. And I can say it's stronger, but it's too much trouble. I was wandering down with the bricks. Hectic, isn't it? Down we go, cradling on. The world's a mess, it's in my kiss. The world's a mess, it's in my kiss. The world's a mess, it's in my kiss. The world's a mess, it's in my kiss.
Thank you.
Stronger than dirt.
Ajax laundry detergent.
We learned our lessons from the Doors.
The Doors, here.
Yeah. Well, you learned your lessons from the Doors, and Ray Manzarek produced like your first few albums and plays on some of your music too. That must have been like remarkable for you. You were big fans of the Doors, and then you end up working with one of them.
Xene and I were big fans of the Doors. I wish that I remember the night that we met. I know it was at the Whiskey A Go Go, and I still miss Ray Manzarek. He was a mentor for sure, a bit of a father figure to mm-hmm. both of us. And it was a miracle. I'm like, this is a real rock star. The Doors were huge, and somehow they got a pass in punk rock because they were chaotic and dark and they meant it, and it was real. Mm-hmm. And Ray did the first four records with us. It was terrific.
And he does a real Ray Manzarek organ solo on the recording of The World's a Mess, It's in My Kiss.
Yes. Yeah, he does.
John, and Xene, I'd like you to tell the story of how you met, because your meeting is actually a really important contribution to the history of punk and to American music.
So I moved to Southern California. Didn't really know where I was. I was in Venice. I got the state was giving me free training to learn a skill. So I learned typesetting and layout, which nowadays wouldn't know what that is. But anyway, pretend like I'm on a computer. Okay, so then I get a placement at this place called Beyond Baroque, which is a Venice poetry workshop started in the 60s. Really amazing place. And I'm working in the library in there, and I'm learning this skill. And I find out there's these poetry readings. I'm living upstairs in this little apartment. And I go one night, because I'm a writer, and I came to California with no career ideas at all, just wanted to get out of Florida. Get there, sit down, guy sits next to me, and, you know, we met. So we met the first night we went to this poetry workshop, and we ended up being part of that. And my son and his dad still are part of that. My son does things there all the time, so it's kind of cool that Beyond Baroque is still there. It's still, you know, a resource for people. It's an amazing place. So it was great that that's where we met, rather than a bar. For once, I met someone not in a bar.
So, John, do you want to add to that story?
I sat down next to Xene because she was the coolest person in the room, the coolest, youngest, best looking person in the room. Little did I realize she was also the smartest, and had the most soul and everything else. But they asked us to fill out a piece of paper with our 10 favorite writers, And Maxine, one of the first things she did was cheat off my papers. She had a few people, and she goes, I don't know poets. What the hell is this? You know. So she looks at my paper and says, oh, by the way, you wrote John Ashbery twice. And I was like, I'm an idiot. So
there's a big kind of romantic ideal of what it must be like to be lovers and in a band together. And John and Maxine, you kind of lived through that. So I'm wondering, like, what's the reality like? Like, what are some of the best and worst parts of being lovers and also being in a band and being on stage every, you know, so many nights together?
Well, I think it's a hard thing to do because you both want to be great. But you're in these weird situations, you know, where people are kind of like hitting on you or trying to like get to meet you. So you have to be pretty solid. And we were pretty solid there, I think. I think the hardest part was sharing the hotel rooms with the roadies because we didn't have enough money to have our own. That was a little awkward night after night, especially when they brought people back, you know. But, you know, I think we had a really sane life, actually. We lived in... For a while, we lived on like the east side of kind of L.A., Mount Washington area, and we had this little wooden house that friends referred to as the Haney place. And you know, we would have a cat, and we would, you know, get up in the morning and eat really nice breakfast, and then do fun stuff, go to museums, and you know, be healthy, and you know, eat Mexican food and hang out with our friends. And then at night, we'd just go wild, and we'd rehearse and make up all this stuff, all these songs, and it was fantastic, really. But, you know, like any relationship, you know, people do change. But I think we coped with that whole thing of being together all the time pretty well, you know, because it can be hard when you're in such a kind of a, I wouldn't say it was a stressful lifestyle, but it was pretty action-packed, and so a lot of things could happen.
Yeah, I would say the best part of it is that you know what each other's going through, because you're with each other 24/7, but that's also the bad part, because you're with each other all the time. In retrospect, I would have given Maxine a lot more space. I would have given myself a little more space. And, you know, it was great, but I think that the difficulty comes in when you, I don't know, you don't like arguing in the same way. Maxine wouldn't argue the way that I wanted her to argue.
What do you mean?
So, I don't know. She just wouldn't get into it. She would just say, I can't. And then she'd just stop. And it would drive me insane. But she was smart because I was probably too volatile to engage at that point.
Do we have to pay you $200 for this?
You know, we
could split it.
One of the problems I could see if you're a couple, if the relationship ends, you know, if the marriage ends, what happens to the band? So when your marriage ended, were you able to play together effectively as a band?
Well, here's the problem. The thing is that during the time when John and I were kind of splitting up, also Billy didn't want to play anymore. So, you know, there's a lot of changes going on. Luckily, we did have Dave and Tony Gilkison, and we kept going for a while. But, you know, then we met people, we had kids, so, you know, it was just, I think, the life of the band kind of ended with around the same time the life of the marriage kind of ended. So it was just time for change. I mean, I met John when I was 20. We were together from the time I was 20, you know. And so we were pretty young, and I think we just wanted to do different things. But we still obviously get along great. We still work together all the time. So, you know, X is still playing. We should say X plays millions of shows, and we are probably happier with each other and all the four of us than we ever have been. And I think we're a better band even than we used to be. So it all worked out, really.
I would say that Maxine and I met as friends. Then we became romantically involved. And then we ended as better friends. We just had to be adult. I felt like it was fate that we met. And I felt like, you know, Maxine and I share something that is like a soulmate thing that a lot of people don't get a chance to. And I'm really grateful for that. X is actually about to celebrate our 40th anniversary. That's pretty frightening. 1977.
I know that Billy Zoom has had cancer, and there was, you know, a campaign to raise money for him. How is his health? Is he able to perform? Does he have
He's
enough
great.
Money to take care of himself?
Billy's great, and this is his second cancer, so he says he doesn't worry about this one so much, but the next one he's kind of concerned about. He's funny. He's got the best sense of humor of anyone in the world. But actually, he's doing fantastic, and I think he really appreciates that he can still do it.
I find it kind of upsetting that, you know, with all of the great music that X contributed, that he didn't have enough money to pay for his medical bills.
And I know he does.
And I know, Ixine, there was a period when you were having trouble with medical bills. And there just seems to be something inherently unfair about that.
Well, actually, I never had trouble paying my bills. I've never had a benefit. I was misdiagnosed with a really bad disease, and I had to wrestle with that. But the thing is that people have insurance and they have Medicare. That doesn't pay your medical bills. Obamacare doesn't pay your medical bills. Nothing pays your medical bills unless you're on a total 100% assistance from the government or something, I suppose. So the knitters, that's why the knitters started to help people pay their bills. You know, you just take care of things, you know, just like any kind of civilized society, you take care of each other. You know, you can't depend on the government or insurance or anything. It's just out of control.
You know, it's one of the things about the L.A. scene of those days is we all live different lives now. You know, we all don't live at the Canterbury and drink beer and hang out. Wish we could. But a couple of years back when my brother was very ill and we needed to raise money quickly, all I did was pick up the phone, got a hold of John and Ixine, said, can you help Phil? My brother, who was sick, called Los Lobos, can you help Phil? Everybody came. It was like 1982 again. Everybody came because we were part of a tribe. And even though the tribe is scattered now, we still come together to help each other. And yeah, these days it seems to be all about health issues as opposed to other things.
If we wanted security, we would have chosen another job.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all right. It's okay. You know, in that way, we're still on the fringe, and that's a good place to be.
John, you have, of everybody's albums here, you've got the most recent one. It's called The Westerner. One of the songs on it is a song that Ixine wrote. It's a great song called Alone in Arizona. And I thought it would be, like, really great if you could sing the song together. Since you've each recorded it separately, Ixine, you recorded it on your 2011 album. John, you recorded it on your new album. You don't perform it with each other on your album, so could I bring you together mm-hmm. to perform it together
sure.
now?
Also, on my version, Dave played on it on my album, so it's kind of...
Oh, so it brings you all together.
We're all here.
Beautiful.
We're all here.
Beautiful.
Oh, I'd like to say that this was, I dedicated my record to an old friend of ours that passed away, Michael Blake. I think about him every time I play or sing this song.
Losing you, my soul is still losing you. The road is rough, I'm losing you.
Losing you.
The sun beats down, losing you. My heart's in California, I'm alone in Arizona. My heart's in California, I'm alone in Arizona.
California, I'm alone in Arizona. My heart's in California, I'm alone in Arizona. My heart's in California, I'm alone in Arizona. Hearts in California, I'm alone in Arizona. My heart's in California, I'm alone in Arizona.
That was John Doe, Exene Cervenka, and Dave Alvin performing Exene's song Alone in Arizona, which Exene recorded on her most recent album and John Doe recorded on his new album. That new album is called The Westerner. It's a beautiful song. John, you said you always think of your friend Michael Blake when you sing it. Tell us something about him and his connection to this song.
Well, Michael Blake is a close friend of ours, passed away last year. He wrote Dances with Wolves and a number of other books. That's what he's best known for. And he was also just a wild, free spirit. We got to be friends in the early 80s, and he and Exene were very, very close. I'm not sure that that's necessarily about him, but I think of it as about him.
Exene, is it about him?
No.
Okay. That clears that up.
No, it's not. But it definitely is now. I mean, it wasn't written about him, but yeah, he lived in Arizona, and before he died, I spent a lot of time going out there to be with him and help him out a little bit, and John did too. And so now it is.
I'm so grateful to the three of you for your music and for doing our show today. Thank you so much, and all best to the three of you.
Thank you so much.
You got it.
You're welcome. Thanks.
John Doe has a new book called Under the Big Black Sun, A Personal History of L.A. Punk, that includes essays by Exene Cervenka and Dave Alvin, as well as others who were part of that scene. John Doe also has a new album called The Westerner. Tomorrow on Fresh Air...
Welcome to a Negro night here at Washington. Or as Fox News will report, two thugs disrupt elegant dinner in D.C.,
That's Larry Wilmore doing stand-up at President Obama's final White House Correspondents' Dinner Saturday night. Tomorrow, I'll talk with him about his performance and its very controversial ending. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a track from John Doe's new album, The Westerner.
Dirty little arms, dirty little hands, shoelaces untied, zipper broken, warm-blooded horse, red-haired kid, he trusted her, his dad never did. Like summer fog, his mom checked out. His Uncle Bill was always hanging around. But all he ever wanted was a little patch of sun. All he ever wanted was